You're listening to LawPod UK. It's a podcast that covers all aspects of civil and public law in the United Kingdom. All comments are current at the time of publication. It's a podcast that's brought to you by the barristers at One Crown Office Row, and this episode is presented by Lucy McCann.
A mountaineer, due to take on a difficult climb, is concerned about the fitness of his knee. He goes to the doctor, who undertakes a superficial examination and negligently pronounces the knee fit. The climber goes on the expedition, which he wouldn't have undertaken if the doctor had told him about the true state of his knee. He suffers an injury, which is an entirely foreseeable consequence of mountaineering, but has nothing to do with his knee. Let's imagine he loses his grip on a ledge and falls. The mountaineer wouldn't have suffered his injury had he been given the correct advice about his knee. But then again, even if the doctor's advice had been correct, the fall would have occurred. It may seem intuitively right that the fall suffered by the mountaineer falls outside the scope of duty of care owed to him by his doctor. But how does one go about reasoning to that conclusion? Is it a question of causation or remoteness? At first glance, the principle that a defendant is only liable for losses which fall within the scope of their duty of care they owe to the claimant seems pretty straightforward, but recent case law navigating this issue shows that this is far from true. Joining me on today's episode of LawPod UK are Marcus Coates-Walker and Rachel Marcus, both barristers at One Crown Office Row, to expertly guide us through some recent decisions on the principle of the scope of duty. Welcome to the podcast, Rachel and Marcus.
Morning.
Morning.
The principle of scope of duty most recently came before the Supreme Court in the case of Khan and Meadows. Marcus, why did this principle need to be revisited by the Supreme Court as recently as 2021 in the case of Khan and Meadows?
Thanks, Lucy. Well, it was raised in Khan in the context of a wrongful birth claim. I think before we look at Khan itself, it's probably useful to have a quick reminder of the key principles underpinning wrongful birth claims generally. This was an issue that was first considered in the context of a healthy child, that meaning a child without disability, by the House of Lords in a case called McFarlane and Tayside Health Board. The House of Lords in that case held that no duty of care was owed to the parents in respect of the financial cost of bringing up a healthy child following negligent advice about or negligent performance of a sterilisation operation. That then set the scene for a series of cases in the early 2000s in which that principle was explored in the context of a disabled child. And there's two further cases of note, one called Parkinson and one called Groom. And the short point is this: in those cases, the parents were not able to recover the cost of bringing up and caring for a normal, healthy child due to the House of Lords decision in McFarlane, but they were entitled to the award of compensation associated with the additional expenses of bringing up a child with a significant disability. Now, in both of those cases, Parkinson and Groom, the disability wasn't caused directly by the negligence of the defendants. That's to say that there was no direct link between negligence and the ensuing disability. In each case, the doctor had undertaken the task of protecting the patient from an unwanted pregnancy. And in both cases, the disability arose from genetic causes or foreseeable events during the course of the pregnancy, which were not due to a new intervening cause. This was deemed by the courts in those cases a sufficient causal link between the defendant's negligence and the disability of the child, and therefore the claimants were able to recover the additional losses associated with bringing up and caring for a child with a significant disability.
Thanks, Marcus. So that's the background. We then turn to Khan and Meadows. Would you mind giving us the facts of that case?
Yeah, the facts of Khan are essentially this: that the claimant consulted her GP with a view to establishing whether she was a carrier of the haemophilia gene, because essentially she wanted to avoid having a child with haemophilia. She was told that her blood test results were normal by her GP. And given that advice, she was led to believe that any child she had would not have haemophilia. The claimant then became pregnant with her son, and shortly after his birth, he was diagnosed with haemophilia. The claimant was referred for genetic testing, which confirmed that she was in fact, contrary to what the GP had led her to believe, she was in fact a carrier of the haemophilia gene. Now, her case was that essentially, had she been referred for genetic testing by the defendant GP, she would have known that she was a carrier before becoming pregnant. Further testing would have revealed that the fetus was affected by that gene, and that she would have then chosen to terminate her pregnancy and her son wouldn't have been born. Now, just to give context, her son's haemophilia is severe, but he was also diagnosed as having autism, which was totally unrelated to the haemophilia, but makes the management of his haemophilia much more complicated. Now, the parties agreed that the defendant GP negligently caused her son to develop haemophilia by failing to determine that the claimant was a carrier of the haemophilia gene. The defendant agreed that the claimant would have terminated her pregnancy. In other words, but for causation was made out. That wasn't an issue. And the defendant also agreed that the claimant could recover the costs associated with her son's haemophilia because of the defendant's negligence. However, what was in dispute was whether the claimant could recover the costs associated with his autism, which the defendant argued was not related to the negligence. In essence, they said it fell out of the scope of the duty owed by the defendant to the claimant. They argued that you can't hold a doctor liable for the risk of a child being born with autism when they had only been asked to advise about the risk of that child having haemophilia. The issue at trial and on appeal, which we'll come on to in a moment, really came down to this question: whether, as a matter of law, the defendant's liability should be limited to losses associated with her son's haemophilia, or whether she should be liable for the additional losses associated with both his haemophilia and autism. Now, the answer to that question resulted in a significant difference between the damages that would be recoverable. To put it into context, if the defendant succeeded and it would only be the losses associated with his haemophilia that were recoverable, the agreed losses were at £1.4 million. If the claimant was right and she was able to recover the losses associated with his haemophilia and autism, then the claim was worth £9 million. So a significant sum turned on the answer to this question.
So what did the majority decide in the Supreme Court? Was this consistent with the decisions of the lower courts?
All of the courts that dealt with this claim had to grapple really with how the question of the scope of the defendant's duty fits into the overall analysis of traditional principles in clinical negligence claims. For example, how it fits with the question of but-for causation. The Supreme Court, in giving a majority judgment, held that even if but-for causation is satisfied, that is not enough. You have to turn your mind to the question of whether the harm falls within the scope of the defendant's duty. You need to separately consider that question before any claim can succeed. Now, in doing that, they set out six questions, which they describe as a helpful model for analysing the place that scope of duty sits in the tort of negligence. The two important questions in this case were, firstly, what are the risks of harm to the claimant against which the law imposes on the defendant a duty to take care? They describe this as the scope of duty question. And secondly, is there a sufficient nexus between a particular element of the harm for which the claimant seeks damages and the subject matter of the defendant's duty of care? And they call this the duty nexus question. Now, in this case, the court held that the scope of duty question was answered by addressing the purpose for which Miss Meadows obtained the service of her GP. She approached her GP for one specific purpose, and that was that she wished to know if she was the carrier of a haemophilia gene. Now, Dr. Khan, they found, owed her a duty to take reasonable care to give accurate information or advice when advising her whether or not she was a carrier of that gene, not whether her child would be born with autism. And therefore, it followed that they found, as did the Court of Appeal, that Dr. Khan was only to be held liable for the costs associated with the care related to the impact of her son's haemophilia, and not any costs associated with the care related to his autism. In other words, they found that the costs associated with her child being born with autism fell outside of the scope of Dr. Khan's duty, because there wasn't a sufficient nexus between that and the purpose for which Miss Meadows was going to see Dr. Khan.
This wasn't a unanimous decision of the court, was it, Rachel? Could you take us through the minority opinions in the Supreme Court?
Yes, so this wasn't a formal dissent. Lord Burrows and Lord Leggett agreed with the overall outcome, namely that the claimant was only entitled to recover for the costs of the haemophilia suffered by her child rather than the costs attendant on his autism. But neither of them thought it was helpful, essentially, to reconceptualise the whole tort of negligence in the way the majority did. Now, Lord Burrows said that expressly, doesn't think it's helpful to use a novel approach, and he differed on the questions to be answered, which he conceptualised in a much more traditional way, which doesn't include this concept of the duty nexus. He went through the very familiar stages that we are all, that are drilled into us from the outset of learning tort. Was there a duty of care? Was there a breach? Factual causation? Was the damage too remote? Was it legally caused by the breach of duty? And then, was the damage within the scope of duty of care? And then, are there any defences? One of the points he made, which I think is very interesting, is that essentially this is the question of the scope of a professional's duty of care is a question of law which is underpinned by a policy of a fair and reasonable allocation of the risk of the loss between the parties. And I'm interested in that as a way of conceptualising the relationship between doctor and patient. And I think we'll discuss that more later. Lord Leggett, too, didn't think it was necessary to discuss the conceptual structure of the whole tort of negligence. But there's an important point he makes in his judgment where he says, at paragraph 84 of the judgment, the purpose for which the patient consults the doctor does not by itself limit the scope of duty, as a doctor's duty will sometimes extend to addressing a matter on which the patient's not asked for advice, but which the doctor recognises or ought to recognise poses a material risk to the patient. And that, as a question, would seem to dovetail with the way in which both patients and doctors conceive of their duty. But there are twists in the tail, which I think we can come on to later. One of the reasons why he thought that it was unnecessary to discuss the whole tort of negligence was that the appeals, and he says this at paragraph 96, are consoled only with the liability of professional purpose for giving negligent advice. And so this is not a question of the whole tort of negligence. How that would differ where what the doctor is doing is not advice, but is an actual, as a physical action, for example, in the case of surgery, might be interesting. But the point that he makes as well is, what has the defendant undertaken responsibility for assessing and advising the claimant about?
Which seems like a slightly different question from this issue of a nexus.
Yes, and the purpose.
Exactly. And so you can see why there's been some confusion, or at least some disagreement between people on what we're actually looking at here when considering scope. Is it a question of responsibility, or is it a question of that kind of factual nexus between the harm and the negligent act? And that's why I guess the sort of mountaineering parable isn't that helpful when thinking about a sort of Clinleg case, because often, as we'll see, the resultant harm is much closer to or much more linked to a consultation or advice. So the lower courts have been grappling with this question and attempting to apply the decision in Carn and Meadows. And I think the most interesting one is the decision in Dee and Grampian Health Board. Marcus, could you talk us through that decision?
Yeah, and I think you've identified the difficulty that the courts are grappling with, is that this is a concept that was derived from cases that dealt with pure economic loss, not clinical negligence. And so what the Supreme Court are trying to do in Carn is give people a roadmap to how the scope of duty test should be applied to tort cases or clinical negligence cases in this instance. And it's interesting to see how judges are grappling with this in courts of first instance. And Dee and Grampian Health Board is a Scottish case which touches on this as part of the overall analysis of the case, doesn't quite deal with it squarely or head on. But in a nutshell, the facts of this case is that the claimant suffered severe brain damage and cerebral palsy as a result of compression of the umbilical cord shortly before birth. Now, it's important to note the mechanism of how this happened for reasons hopefully that will become clear. The evidence showed that this was caused by the unforeseen and dramatic pace of mum's labour, causing the claimant's head to descend in the pelvis very quickly and completely occlude the umbilical cord. In other words, it happened quite quickly before ultimately the claimant was delivered. Now, part of the claim concerned failures by the midwives in the antenatal care period, a day or so before delivery. Now, what the claimant argued in this case is that those failures, which involved administration of prostaglandin and failures to refer for medical review, that those failures should have led to an earlier delivery. And that earlier delivery would have avoided any brain damage and disability. Now, the court found on the question of breach of duty that the defendants hadn't been negligent and the breach wasn't made out. However, it then went on to address the question of if breach had been established, would the harm suffered fall within the scope of the defendant's duty in relation to the midwifery care? Now, what the judge said was that it would have found in those circumstances that the harm was too remote for there to be the necessary sufficient nexus between any breaches of duty on behalf of the midwives and the adverse outcome. So it would have fallen foul of the scope of duty question. In doing so, it provided some analysis that might give us a bit of an insight into how judges are likely to grapple with this question post-Carn in clinical negligence cases. The court accepted the proposition that induction of labour and subsequent delivery are, in a general sense, linked to the extent that they can not be seen as two separate services. So there is a general link to some extent between the induction of labour and subsequent delivery. However, they said the real difficulty for the claimant in this case was that on the evidence, the only consequence of any breach on behalf of the midwives, what they said there wasn't any evidence about was how and why that delay would have altered the outcome. And it was effectively on that basis, albeit obiter, that they said there wasn't a sufficient connection between the breach and the harm. So that duty nexus question that we've seen arise out of the Supreme Court's decision in Carn wasn't satisfied. Now, whilst this might be a case on proper analysis that looks to blur the lines between analysing causation and scope of duty, and for what it's worth, reading that section of the judgment seems to indicate what the judge was really concerned about was that there was no causative impact of the specific breaches asserted against the midwives. It does raise an interesting question of whether harm caused due to a prolonged pregnancy, a negligently prolonged pregnancy, whether that can fall outside the scope of the duty owed by the midwives responsible for aspects of that baby's antenatal care. And whereas we can see a strong distinction potentially between holding a GP liable for risks that flow from getting negligent advice about whether you're the carrier of the haemophilia gene wrong, and a baby ultimately being born with autism, of which the GP wasn't asked any questions about or expected to provide any advice about. It's more difficult in these sorts of circumstances, perhaps, to see that distinction between the midwives and the obstetric medical team in a much shorter space of time, when overall, on behalf of the trust, they are assuming the responsibility for making sure that baby is delivered safely and that pregnancy ends safely. And so I think it does raise an interesting question of how Khan is going to be firstly deployed by parties moving forward, and secondly, how it's going to be dealt with by the courts when faced with these arguments.
Yeah, I think you're right, Marcus. I find the outcome quite a difficult one. I can see conceptually a lack of a nexus between haemophilia and autism, but I struggle a lot more with the notion that there isn't a link between the induction of labour and midwifery care and labour itself. And I just think this does have implications for clinical practice and seems quite far removed from, I think, the realities of healthcare and the provision of healthcare. Rachel, what do you think about this?
Yeah, I think that's really significant. And the mention of Grampian and setting it out in the way that Marcus just did caused a really big intake of breath and buzz in the room at a recent seminar we had, which is what prompted us to do this podcast, because there was clearly so much consternation about it. It's a Scottish case, of course, but it's interesting for the way in which it addresses the law in Khan. Interestingly, the way in which the court approached it, albeit obiter, in the Grampian case, aligns with what I heard in a recent case conference, where the experts were critical of the team for not inducing a patient earlier. But the advice had been by the obstetric expert, and indeed had been replicated in the serious incident report, that failing had no impact on the outcome, where a couple of days later, the reading of the CTG when the patient was in fact in labour was negligent. Now, that makes no sense at all on a Chester and Afshar basis or even a standard causation basis, because inducing earlier meant that the patient would have been on a CTG earlier, and you have to assume that that would not have been negligently read. And so the baby's distress would have been recognised and the baby born intact. But I thought it's interesting that the instinct of the experts and the way things were approached from the clinician's point of view was the same as the way in which things were conceptualized in Grampian. I don't know if Grampian makes sense on a scope of duty or duty nexus basis, because actually if you look on the other hand as scope of duty being more focused on the ultimate harm, you can come to a very different outcome. And there's another Scottish case which does exactly that, DD and the NHS Fife Health Board. Interestingly, same advocate for the pursuer as was in Grampian. In that case, there was a doctor who was accused of negligently discharging the equivalent of a mental health section. And the pursuer, who was the patient, then sadly created all sorts of criminal and civil havoc to himself and others arising out of his mental state, and sued the doctor for the consequences. And the court, this is the Sheriff Appeal Court, found that the court below should have applied Khan and Meadows. And when addressing how that should have been applied, focused heavily on the actual nature of the damage when determining the scope of duty, but sidestepped making any decision about that, essentially remitting the case back to the sheriff for other reasons. But when it came to the scope of duty question, said, deciding conclusively what is or is not recoverable may only be capable of proper resolution after evidence has been led as to the particular medical condition and the particular heads of claim advanced by him. I'm not sure about that. That sounds a lot like foreseeability to me rather than scope of duty, which is a strictly legal question, slightly more remote from the question of the harm. But it is an interesting way in which the duty nexus question was addressed. And when it comes to scope of duty being a strictly legal question rather than an expert question, there's another case in which this was addressed obliquely to a certain extent, and that's Radier and Marx, which is a case about the duties of experts, which Emma-Louise Fenelon and Margaret Bowron talked about, I think, in a recent podcast. Mrs. Justice Lambert found that essentially she wasn't assisted by expert evidence because the scope of duty is a legal question for the court alone. And she pointed out that the scope of duty is not a new ingredient in the tort of negligence, although its location in the analysis, she said, may have been elevated as a result of the judgment in Meadows. And the issue for her, she found, was whether the scope of an expert's duty to the claimant extends to protect him from the risk of an adverse credibility finding or a finding of dishonesty. And unsurprisingly, she found that it didn't. She addressed the question with a letter of instruction, which wasn't to comment on credibility, any event, not his expertise. And it's not the role of an expert to support credibility or protect a claimant from adverse findings. And the important thing, as I said, is that for our purposes, is that Mrs. Justice Lambert ignored the expert evidence instructed for the High Court completely when addressing the question of scope of duty. It's not a question for experts. It's absolutely clear that it's a question of law alone, not expert evidence. So, coming back to Grampian for a moment and the question of the focus on the harm, one of the things I wondered is if the question in Grampian had been framed in the same way as the court did in the Fife case, the real focus on the medical condition and the harm suffered, the duty nexus might have been established, because the harm, essentially, as you were hinting with Lucy and Marcus, which both midwives and doctors want to avoid, is damage to the baby. And that's the whole point of early induction. So separating the two out, as they did in Grampian, seems to me to be very difficult.
I agree with Rachel. And it's a question of where the court's going to draw the lines, really, moving forward. And in Grampian, the sense I get from the judgment, Rachel, is that the court really focused on two things. One, the sudden severe damage caused right at the end of the pregnancy, rather than an ongoing process of something happening over a period of time. And B, the lack of any evidence showing that, aside from the general point around delaying the pregnancy, the lack of any harm flowing from the breaches of duty on behalf of the midwives, in terms of, for example, that there was no evidence, it said in the judgment, of any harm flowing from the failure to administer prostaglandin, or for referring for medical review at that stage. And so I wonder whether it is quite fact specific, but in those circumstances, whether if you've got a period of time between the midwife involvement and the delivery of a baby, whether the longer that period of time and the longer the interval between the involvement of the midwives and the actual delivery, whether that makes a difference, and whether that's going to be something the court looks at in terms of defining where to draw the line in relation to scope of duty in clinical negligence claims, when you're looking at the same trust and the same department, and as you say, assuming the same responsibility for ultimately getting this baby out safely.
And I think the difference in the case conference that I had was that the advice was the CTG had in fact been read negligently in relation to the allegations against the obstetricians. And so it's not quite the same case in Grampian, where there was no finding of negligence against the obstetricians. And then we sort of fell back on the it's a sort of Chester and Afshar point, really. The day before, you can't assume that it would have been read negligently, because if the same course had happened in labour as the expert evidence said it would have done with earlier induction, then the baby would have been born intact. So again, very fact specific on the advice you're getting from your experts in relation to how things would have shaped up. What I find interesting in relation to the expert evidence is that clinical negligence, as a matter of the way in which we approach cases, does focus very closely on the individual specialty of the clinician when you're addressing breach of duty. So you get a midwifery expert for the midwives and an obstetrician for the obstetricians. Even though, of course, the duty is owed by the corporate body in the form of the NHS Trust or Health Board, what the scope of duty and the duty nexus question focuses the mind on is on the individual doctor and that individual doctor's individual specialty. And I'm quite interested in that conceptually, because there is, I think, a sort of coherence to the way in which the law appears to approach these things. There is a sort of stay in your lane approach. And I was thinking as a parallel, the McCulloch case, which was about what test you, in the Supreme Court, was about what test you apply when advising a patient of reasonable alternatives to treatment. Now, it's a breach of duty case, not a scope of duty case. But in finding that the Bolam test is to be applied as to what reasonable alternatives are to be discussed with a patient, and in finding that test applies to whether a doctor has a duty to discuss alternative treatments that they themselves do not consider reasonable ones, it focuses very much on the individual clinician rather than the subjective interests or wishes of the particular patient. Now, I note that in Carne Meadows, the Supreme Court didn't place any weight really on Mr. Haver's submissions for the claimant, where he referred to the imbalance of knowledge and power between the clinician and the patient. And I find that interesting, because this question of what's the allocation of risk here? And it appears to be, I'm reminded of the Fife case, where the defenders and possibly the court too were critical of the what was described as an attempt by the pursuer to make the defenders the insurers of the pursuer for all which happened to him after the alleged negligence. Now, there were other control mechanisms, of course, in that case, such as ex turpi causa. But fundamentally, this distinction, as it's referred to in Carne Meadows, between the factual consequences of a defendant's breach of duty and the legally relevant ones, it strikes me as the sort of thing where, when advising claimants, we might have to find ourselves explaining how the law doesn't necessarily correspond with what they think is common sense. And the scope of duty and the duty nexus probably does coincide with the way in which clinicians think about the duty they owe to the patients. It probably doesn't with the way in which patients think about the duty owed to them by doctors, especially because of this power and knowledge imbalance.
I suppose we're talking about this in the context of this arising out of the Kahn decision in 2021. But if we take a step back, I suppose we can see that this is something that the courts have been doing for some time. And by that, I mean using legal policy to influence the analysis of the case as a whole or the law as a whole. And that brings us full circle back to the McFarlane, Parkinson and Groom cases, where that's essentially what they did in drawing a distinction between what you can recover for a healthy child and a disabled child in wrongful birth claims. And so whilst it's a relatively new concept or process of applying the scope of duty question to clinical negligence claims, it's not a new concept in terms of the courts approaching matters where they feel, I suppose, at the heart of it, it's unfair for the defendant to be liable or responsible for those damages, and therefore they're going to devise a legal policy in one way or another that means that the claimant can't succeed on those points.
Yes, precisely. What the court in Fife described as essentially you're making the clinician, the insurer, for everything that happens to you afterwards.
Yeah, I also think this raises an interesting question in relation to the role of AI in medicine and clinical practice. If AI is given very specific tasks and so can't think more widely or holistically about patient care, or if it can do far more than a human clinician can hope to do in one consultation. So take the example of medical imaging, being able to look at a scan and look for more than perhaps a human could. Either scenario, I think, complicates the scope of duty question somewhat, because what AI is capable of doing, and therefore what resultant harm it might be liable for, could be altered. I'm just throwing that out there. I don't have an answer, but I think it's an interesting question.
Yeah, this is interesting, because if we conceptualize the scope of duty and duty nexus question as about, you know, what inputs are you putting into your clinician? You know, what prompts are you giving the AI? And the point you raise about radiology is interesting, because there have been recent cases about what a radiologist is supposed to look at. Do they just look at the clinical question that they're asked? Or do they look at everything that's on the scan for any other abnormalities? And of course, a human clinician can do that very easily. Now, with AI, it will depend on the prompt. And I think that does bring us back to this question that Lord Leggett raised in Kahn, which is, well, the doctor's not just responsible for the specific question asked by the patient, actually. She's also responsible for anything where the doctor recognises or ought to recognise a material risk to the patient. And that must be right.
Yes.
And the question is, how does that dovetail with the question of the purpose for which the advice is sought? And I think that is an interesting question as AI comes more into healthcare. What are the prompts that are being given? And presumably, I mean, my conclusion is that you can never do away with essentially the clinical acumen of the clinician.
But, you know, my simplistic way of looking at it, who's responsible? Is it the tech specialists who are devising the AI product, or is it ultimately the legal input and whoever's responsible for sort of defining those features?
And I think that throws up more difficulties in terms of liability. I mean, you can't hold an algorithm liable, but then do you hold the people behind the algorithm liable, or is the AI sort of learning on its own? And if it is, then where do you go from there? I think this is beyond the scope of this episode.
I think you need a new podcast you need a new podcast on AI with somebody who actually knows about AI, and that's not me at this juncture.
Well, thank you so much, both of you, for coming on the podcast. It's been a fascinating discussion. And as ever, I will link all of the cases that we've discussed today in the blog post accompanying the episode in case you want to follow up on anything we've discussed. Thank you very much for joining me today, Rachel and Marcus.
Thank you, Lucy.
Thanks, Lucy.
This episode of LawPod UK was presented by Lucy McCann. The series is produced by One Crown Office Row and Podcasts for Lawyers.